Good morning, and welcome to Simply Economics. It's Sunday, April 21st. On today's show, the state is poised to become Australia's star performer. And after decades of rising economic integration, the global economy is fragmenting. What can Australia do about it? Plus, the City Council votes 32-17 to borrow $1.25 billion to fund economic initiatives. This coverage and more, up next. I'm David, and you're listening to Simply Economics. We start off with some interesting developments in the Australian economy. South Australia has held on to its crown as the best-performing economy in the country for another quarter, but Western Australia is nipping at its heels. According to the latest State of the States report from Commonwealth Bank, WA has leapfrogged over Victoria and is poised to overtake SA. Here with more details is our economics correspondent. What has kept South Australia at the top of the economic leaderboard?
South Australia's strong workforce and good record of getting construction work done have been key factors in its economic outperformance. The state has consistently ranked highly on metrics like construction work, equipment investment, and relative unemployment. This indicates a robust job market and healthy business investment, which are pillars of economic growth.
And what about Western Australia? How has it managed to surge ahead of Victoria in the rankings?
Western Australia's economy has been buoyed by the mining sector, which has seen strong demand and high commodity prices. This has flowed through to other parts of the state's economy, with rising business investment and a tightening job market. WA's unemployment rate is now the second lowest in the country, behind only the ACT. The state government's budget is also in a strong position, with large surpluses forecast in the coming years.
Looking ahead, do you think Western Australia can overtake South Australia in the next quarter?
It's certainly possible. Western Australia has a lot of momentum behind it, and the mining boom shows no signs of slowing down. However, South Australia has proven to be remarkably resilient, with a diverse economy that isn't overly reliant on any one sector. It also has a strong pipeline of construction work, particularly in the renewable energy space. So while WA is definitely a contender, South Australia won't give up its title easily.
Are there any potential headwinds that could slow down either state's economy?
The biggest risk for both states is probably the global economic outlook. If there's a significant slowdown in China or other major trading partners, that could put a dent in demand for commodities and other exports. Rising interest rates could also cool the housing market and business investment. However, both SA and WA have proven to be adaptable in the face of economic challenges, so they're well positioned to weather any potential storms.
Thanks for that analysis. It will be interesting to see if Western Australia can overtake South Australia in the next State of the States report. On a broader scale, the global economy is fragmenting after decades of rising economic integration, according to a recent paper titled, Are We Fragmented Yet? Measuring Geopolitical Fragmentation and Its Causal Effects. The paper's Geopolitical Fragmentation Index shows that while the world economy became more integrated from the mid-1990s through the mid-2000s, that trend reversed after the global financial crisis, and fragmentation has continued to increase in recent years. Here with more insight is our Simply Economics correspondent, Michael. The paper cites events like Brexit, the U.S.-China trade war, the pandemic, and the war in Ukraine as straining international relations and forcing a rethink of economic strategies. How concerning is this trend of increasing fragmentation?
It's definitely a worrying trend, David. The IMF has warned that if this geoeconomic fragmentation deepens, we could find ourselves in a new Cold War. While policymakers can seek pragmatic solutions to minimize the costs, like preserving free trade benefits where possible, the reality is the global economy is splintering into competing blocks. This threatens to undo many of the economic efficiency and growth benefits reaped from globalization in recent decades.
And it's not just the IMF sounding the alarm. Europe also seems to be preparing for this new era of strategic competition, with former ECB President Mario Draghi working on a plan to revitalize the EU economy to better compete with the US and China. What can you tell us about that?
In a recent speech in Brussels, Draghi acknowledged that competitiveness has long been a contentious issue for Europe. He referenced economist Paul Krugman's view that focusing on competitiveness is a dangerous obsession, and that long-term growth comes from raising productivity rather than trying to capture market share from others. However, Draghi seems to be arguing that the approach Europe took after its sovereign debt crisis, which aligns with Krugman's view, may no longer be tenable in the current geopolitical reality. Reading between the lines, it appears Draghi is laying the groundwork for a more aggressive European industrial policy to shore up the bloc's competitiveness vis-a-vis the US and China.
Very interesting. So, in the face of all this, what can a country like Australia do? Prime Minister Anthony Albanese recently gave a speech warning about this trend and the need for Australia to be clear-eyed about the economic realities of increasing strategic competition. How should Australia position itself?
It's a difficult balance for Australia. On one hand, as a highly trade-exposed economy, Australia has benefited immensely from globalization and has a strong interest in preserving an open, rules-based economic order. But it can't ignore the reality that its major trading partners are increasingly viewing economics through a national security lens. Australia will likely need to take steps to reduce its economic vulnerability, like diversifying trade relationships and shoring up domestic manufacturing in strategic industries. At the same time, as a middle power, Australia has an interest in defending globalization and the multilateral trading system where possible. Expect to see Australia working through groupings like the G20 and WTO to argue against fragmentation while hedging against it bilaterally.
Thank you, Michael, for your insights on this important and still unfolding story. We'll be sure to check in again as events develop in what is certainly a difficult balance in an increasingly complex geopolitical and economic environment. Shifting our focus now to domestic affairs, the Chicago City Council has voted to borrow $1.25 billion over the next 5 years to fund a wide range of projects aimed at expanding affordable housing and creating good-paying jobs in the city. The move is a major victory for Mayor Brandon Johnson, who campaigned on making Chicago a more equitable place to live without raising property taxes. For more on this, we turn to our correspondent. Can you give us some background on why this proposal was put forward?
Mayor Johnson has been a strong advocate for investing in Chicago's communities, particularly those that have been historically underserved due to the legacy of modern segregation. By borrowing this money, the city will be able to provide assistance for new businesses, restaurants, affordable homes, and cultural facilities in areas where economic development has been stagnant or declining for many years. This marks a significant shift in how Chicago uses its financial resources to spur redevelopment and address blight.
The vote was delayed by 48 hours due to opposition from some city council members. What were their main concerns?
The primary sticking point centered around the level of control the city council would have over how the funds are spent. In response to these concerns, Mayor Johnson added a provision requiring city council approval for any project exceeding $5 million. Some alderpeople, such as Brendan Riley and Raymond Lopez, pushed for even lower thresholds, arguing that this is not play money and that greater oversight is necessary. However, their efforts to amend the proposal on the council floor ultimately failed.
This borrowing plan is tied to phasing out the city's reliance on tax increment financing districts, or TIFs. Can you explain what those are and why the city is moving away from them?
TIFs have been Chicago's primary tool for funding economic development efforts for decades. Essentially, they freeze property tax revenues in a designated area and redirect any future growth in those revenues toward development projects within that district. While TIFs have been credited with spurring redevelopment in some areas, critics argue that they divert much-needed funds from schools and other public services, and that they primarily benefit already thriving neighborhoods. By borrowing this money instead, the city aims to have more flexibility in targeting its investments where they are needed most.
Alderwoman Pat Dowell, chair of the Finance Committee, called this proposal historic. What makes it so significant?
This borrowing plan represents a major shift in how Chicago approaches economic development. Rather than relying on TIFs, which are tied to specific geographic areas, the city will now have a pool of funds that it can use to support projects across the city, including in neighborhoods that have seen little investment in recent years. Dowell emphasized that this is not a blank check and that there will be oversight in how the money is spent. But it does give the city more flexibility to direct resources where they are needed most, in line with Mayor Johnson's vision for a more equitable Chicago.
Thank you for that insightful analysis. It will be interesting to see how this plays out and what kinds of projects end up being funded through this borrowing plan. We will continue to follow this story as it develops. Meanwhile, Neil Woodford, once Britain's star fund manager, is attempting to reinvent himself as an economic commentator after his investment empire collapsed in a major scandal in 2019. Woodford recently pointed to many reasons to be cheerful about the country's economic prospects, despite the Financial Conduct Authority issuing a warning notice against him just a week ago. For more on this story, we turn to our correspondent. Can you give us some background on what led to the collapse of Woodford's investment fund?
In 2019, Woodford's £3.7 billion flagship fund faced a crisis when a large number of investors tried to withdraw their money simultaneously. The fund was unable to return investments quickly enough to meet this sudden demand, leaving around 300,000 investors unable to access their funds. This liquidity crunch exposed significant issues in how the fund was managed and the types of assets it held. The scandal ultimately led to the complete collapse of Woodford's investment empire.
And now, just a week after the Financial Conduct Authority issued a warning notice against Woodford, he's resurfaced as an economic commentator. What did the regulators' notice say about his conduct?
The Financial Conduct Authority's warning notice stated that Woodford had a defective and unreasonably narrow understanding of his responsibilities in managing the failed fund. This suggests that the regulator found serious fault with Woodford's leadership and decision-making during the period leading up to the fund's collapse. The notice is a formal step that could lead to disciplinary action or fines against Woodford, depending on the outcome of the ongoing investigation.
Given the scale of the scandal and the regulatory scrutiny he's facing, it's certainly a bold move for Woodford to start commenting on the state of the British economy. What reasons did he cite for his optimistic outlook?
In his recent comments, Woodford pointed to many reasons to be cheerful about Britain's economic prospects, though he didn't provide specific details. It's worth noting that prior to his fund's collapse, Woodford was known for his contrarian investment style and often made bullish bets on smaller, riskier companies. Some observers might see his latest commentary as an attempt to rehabilitate his image and reestablish his credibility as a financial expert, despite the serious questions raised by the scandal.
It will be interesting to see how Woodford's attempted comeback as an economic commentator is received, given the fallout from his fund's collapse and the ongoing regulatory investigation. The 300,000 investors who were unable to access their money may not be so quick to forget the scandal or to trust Woodford's judgment again. Thank you for your insights on this developing story. And with that, we wrap up our stories for today. Thanks for listening to Simply Economics. We'll see you back here tomorrow.